Hello, I'm Keith Parent, and welcome to Focus Asia Pacific. Coming up on today's program, fresh threats from North Korea as the U.S. and South Korea begin war games, the Chinese president on a tour of Africa, and foreign maids in Hong Kong won't be granted residency. We have this and much more on this edition of Focus Asia Pacific, putting the focus on the Asia Pacific.
From this moment, the Supreme Command of the Korean People's Army will be putting into combat duty all field artillery units, including long-range artillery units and strategic rocket units that will target South Korea as well as U.S. invasionary bases on its mainland, Hawaii and Guam.
That was a translation from North Korean state television. North Korea is again retching up its threats and aggressive rhetoric, this time in response to U.S. warplanes recently spotted over the Korean Peninsula. The announcement that Pyongyang is preparing for a possible attack in the region came on the day South Korea marked the third anniversary of the sinking of its warship, Cheongnan. On Tuesday, South Korea issued its own warning, saying it'll retaliate 1,000 times should North Korea choose a more aggressive path. Next, Liam Cochran speaks to Professor Felix Patrickev, an associate professor of politics at the University of Adelaide.
The reaction, your reaction, first of all, to this these latest threats from North Korea.
Well, I think you caught a little bit of the reason why there's been such a strident response, and that's the war games that South Korea and the U.S. the tactical exercises that they've been conducting, and clearly they've actually trod very heavily on the foot of North Korea. But we've also got to take into consideration the fact that North Korea is a past master in brinksmanship. You know, it's actually based a lot of its internal politics on the assumption that there is this enemy out beyond its borders, and that is the United States, which is the puppet master of South Korea. From time to time, it does actually ratchet it up in order to make it sound as if everything's on a war footing. But the real question is whether or not they can be on that particular war footing at the moment.
Why is that? Why might they not be able to be?
Well, purely because their missiles are hardly able to get to mainland United States, and certainly not to deliver any significant payload. Even Hawaii would actually be difficult. That doesn't mean that they can't launch into South Korea, but clearly the value of that is uncertain, both for North and South, because it could result in very quick and rather disastrous escalation. So unlikely that missiles would go into South Korea, but unlikely that they could reach their targets as specified by North Korea.
I mentioned in the introduction the third anniversary to the sinking of the Cheongnan warship. The U.S. war games that are happening at the moment, I mean, are these two things happening purely in coincidence together, or is there some link between them? Is there some bolstering of South Korea's security for the occasion of that anniversary?
Well, clearly, and you've caught a very important point, and that is that clearly there's a great deal of symbolism involved in North-South relations, and the Cheongnan actually was an immense blow to South Korea, both strategically and also in terms of the symbolism. So it was appropriate for the South and for America to actually bolster popular feeling in terms of saying never again, and demonstrating that with a certain amount of flexing of military muscles.
We had recently the UN Human Rights Commission decision to establish a commission of inquiry into North Korea's abuses within the country. How might that have gone down within North Korea, within the citizens and the leadership of the country, and what sort of repercussions might we perhaps see?
Well, it went down very badly, and there was a rather brusque response to that. But I think far more pointed and far more irritating to North Korea is the increase in sanctions that resulted from their explosion of a thermonuclear device underground recently. And so there's an escalation in a variety of areas, and North Korea must be at this point feeling that it's being surrounded in a very uncomfortable way, which usually then is reacted to by coming out with strident statements about the omnipotence of the leader and equally of the future sort of path of the country of North Korea.
We're almost used to hearing these statements of brinkmanship from the halls of power in Pyongyang. I mean, do we still have to take every one of these seriously, or is it? You know, is there a sense of the boy who cried wolf sometimes here?
Yep, there is a little bit of an element of, or a question mark, should I say, regarding the new supreme leader's position in within the power structure of North Korea. So it could be the military actually exerting a little bit of pressure on Kim Jong-un in order to sort of push him in a certain direction, or it could be a response from him in order to pull himself in another direction. So there's always that possibility. But in terms of the brinksmanship, they've very often actually come out with extremely provocative statements and then withdrawn. Today's situation is somewhat different in the sense that it's the supreme command of the military that has actually been coming out with a statement, which is really suggesting that they're on a war footing in a more than a symbolic sense. And of course, we have to remember that North Korea has also sort of torn up the armistice and saying that the truce is over between North and South. So that complicates matters a little as well.
China's new president, Xi Jinping, has embarked on a diplomatic offensive barely a week after being sworn in. Following his first visit to Russia, the Chinese leader is on a three-nation tour of Africa, including Tanzania, South Africa, and the Republic of Congo. In South Africa, he will attend a summit which will include Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. Xi Jinping tours of Africa is the first overseas trip and suggests the importance Africa places on the continent's oil, minerals, and resources. Kandahar Sapati has more.
China's involvement in the African continent is not recent. In fact, the Tanzania-Zambia railway line, built in the early 1970s, was one of the most visible landmarks of Chinese infrastructural development in Africa. But in recent times, as China's economy expands and its industries demand more energy, Africa has become the major supplier of minerals and gas and oil. This has led to the perception that China is stripping the continent of its raw materials while flooding the African markets with Chinese goods. It's an accusation which Dr. David Dawood, an associate with La Trobe University, says is neither totally true nor fair.
Sometimes the Chinese have been willing to strike deals that are much better for African countries than either North America or the EU have been willing to do. After all, Chinese investment is driven by strategic interest, not by the profit line of a private company, which gives it a different hue altogether. It doesn't mean that China is benign, but it is a different type of development investment.
China has also been generous in its no-strings-attached aid, interest-free loans, and infrastructural development projects in a number of African countries. And while Africans do see China as a healthy counterbalance to the West's influence, there is a growing wariness that Chinese investments and infrastructural developments are more to China's benefit. Dr. Tanya Lance is from the School of International Studies at Flinders University.
There's a lot of question about when infrastructure projects are built. A lot of Chinese labour is sent in to do the work, so there's no employment for African peoples in those contexts, and that's been a problem. There's been a problem with local manufacturing businesses, particularly pronounced in South Africa, where manufacturing sectors are undercut by the cheaper imports from China. And, you know, they're now competing on the global stage. These African economies have to compete with cheap imports from China, and that's left a sour taste in some people's mouths.
Speaking in the Tanzanian economic capital, Dar es Salaam, President Xi Jinping said Africa belongs to the Africans and all countries must respect Africa's dignity and independence. He signed 16 different trade and cultural development accords with the Tanzanian president and hailed the strong relations that China has built with African countries. But some Chinese investment practices in Africa have been described as racist and self-serving. Dr. Lyons.
A lot of people call it a new form of colonialism in that they are building roads and railways and port facilities to get the resources out. And that's what's required. It's what happened during the colonial era and it's what's happening now, but without the need for direct political and administrative colonization.
Despite this, Chinese companies tend to stand better opportunities in Africa for a number of reasons, says Dr. Lyons.
I guess because a lot of the companies going in are state-owned or state-supported by the Chinese, they don't have the issues that shareholders in Western countries put on their companies to be socially responsible and environmentally responsible. And I guess their strategy is quite different to the traditional Western strategies, and they certainly have a good audience in African countries with leaders who think of the structural adjustment programs of the international financial institutions and prefer to take aid from people who are not putting too many pressures on them, such as human rights demands and other such things.
The willingness of China to line the pockets of dictators and overlook issues like human rights abuses and environmental degradation, so long as it gets to exploit the resources, has often led to strong criticisms. Dr. Dawood says while practices like these are not good in the long term, the West has a worse track record than China.
In the past, China has not exported its political agendas in terms of the domestic policies of other countries, whereas there's a whole litany of American, French, and even British interventions in post-colonial Africa to change governments that were unfavorable to American, European self-interest.
At the upcoming 5th BRICS Summit in Durban, South Africa, Mr. Xi is expected to discuss plans to create a joint foreign exchange reserves pool. The proposal underscores frustrations among emerging markets at having to meet tough World Bank and IMF conditions for assistance. With its growing economic clout, BRICS, which encompasses Brazil, Russia, India, China and South Africa, could provide that alternative.
In a landmark decision, Hong Kong's highest court has ruled against granting residency to domestic workers. The decision by five judges in the Court of Final Appeal has dashed the hopes of maids and home helpers who aspire to become permanent residents of Hong Kong. The court ruled that they may not apply for permanent residency even after 7 years, the period that normally applies to other foreigners under the law. Rights groups say the decision is not only discriminatory, but also socially exclusive. Sen Lam speaks to Annie Lestari, a spokeswoman from the Asian Migrants Coordinating Body, an alliance in Hong Kong for domestic workers from the Philippines, Indonesia, Nepal, Sri Lanka and Thailand.
This is a very sad and very disappointing decision that the court also giving a stamp to the other department in Hong Kong to allow such discrimination to even exist in the law and also the practice of the Hong Kong government. Now we can tell to the public that such discrimination against foreign domestic workers in Hong Kong is really existing, not only because we feel about that, but even the law implement discrimination by denying chance of being PR in Hong Kong.
And Annie, you say it's disappointing for the domestic workers, but is it not in their contract that their tenure do not guarantee them eventual permanent residency in Hong Kong?
No, the contract was only stating about the living condition of domestic worker in the employer house. It doesn't say at all they will never be a Hong Kong permanent resident. That is under the Hong Kong immigration policies, that domestic workers is one of the biggest sectors who cannot be a PR in Hong Kong.
And do you think many domestic workers in Hong Kong from foreign lands, that they aspire to permanent residency in Hong Kong?
There are many domestic workers do not really aspire to be a Hong Kong resident in the first place. Among the Indonesian, I can say, since I'm Indonesian, most of them will always want to go home to Indonesia. And only few who think they have a capability of even living in Hong Kong who might want. But the problem is even that chance of applying is not even there. So even they have capability, they will not be able to apply at all. And also from the fact when we won in the first hearing, less than 1,000 applied to the immigration department. Unlike what the government has claimed that there will be 125,000 domestic workers applying if we win.
Are you saying then that the Hong Kong authorities are exercising double standards here where foreign domestic workers are concerned?
Yes, actually they enforce a double requirements. But beyond that, for us this is about social exclusion. They intentionally exclude foreign domestic workers who has been helping Hong Kong family and who has been helping Hong Kong economy from the social benefit. And that's the only reason is because we are foreign domestic workers. For us, it's about class discrimination.
I suppose one might argue that this is because of the sheer numbers, because there are over 300,000 foreign domestic workers in Hong Kong.
Yes, but a number doesn't mean that all of us will apply. And yet, remember, the law said that all foreigners who actually enter legally in Hong Kong and then live normally in Hong Kong, we have a proper job in Hong Kong, is actually equivalent in the eyes of the law. But now when it comes to implementation, it's only foreign domestic worker being rejected in the law.
What about Evangeline Vallejos herself, the Filipina maid who brought this action to begin with and who appealed? Yeah. I understand she's lived in Hong Kong since 1986. So yeah. In real terms, what does this mean for her?
Well, we spoke to the lawyer today. We did not meet her because he doesn't really want to be exposed in the public. But according to the lawyer, Evangeline just said that she was very sad and this is unfair. That's what she said. This is unfair.
Many people in Hong Kong feel that the population is already bursting at the seams and that there is no room to give foreign domestic workers permanent residency. But what do you think employers feel about it? Because domestic workers, they are a great resource to many of Hong Kong's employers.
I can say that many of the Hong Kong people, even employers, are having very strong fear of even recognizing such rights for domestic workers. They are so afraid because they have been given a wrong information by the government. Even the political parties who are very anti-migrant workers are very racist, I can say, and who has been telling the public that if they allow these foreign domestic workers to be Hong Kong permanent resident, there will be 125,000 will apply. There will be a lot of babies and family coming over here that we will actually eat the subsidy of the Hong Kong people. But is it true? From the reality that we found in the ground, many of them still want to go home.
And if you've just tuned in, you're listening to Focus Asia Pacific, coming to you from PCJ Radio International.
Hi, this is Bob Zanotti. Do you miss Swiss Radio International? If so, I invite you to visit my website, switzerlandinsound.com. Colorful and informative radio features about Switzerland, its destinations, interesting people, politics, culture, and even the two Bobs, switzerlandinsound.com. where English language radio from Switzerland lives on.
Questions have been raised about how Australia's border protection authorities handled an asylum seeker boat which capsized near Christmas Island this week. A young boy and a woman drowned in the incident. Three others had narrowly escaped. After finding the boat, border protection officials waited 8 hours before boarding it. While the government says there are good reasons for that, a longtime observer of asylum seeker tragedies at sea said it could have been handled differently. Lexi Merriweather has more.
The crew of the boat carrying 96 asylum seekers contacted the Australian Maritime Safety Authority on Sunday night. It's understood they said they were lost. 45 minutes later, a border protection vessel called Ocean Protector was on its way to the boat, which was not far from Christmas Island. It took 5 hours to get there, and once it arrived, it waited. The commander of Border Protection, Rear Admiral David Johnston, explained why at a press conference this week.
The protocol in these circumstances, particularly conducting boardings at night, are dangerous. In the absence of an immediate appearance of distress, preference would be to conduct a day boarding, safer for our people and often for those that are on board.
When dawn broke 8 hours after the Ocean Protector arrived, it dispatched smaller boats to the asylum seeker vessel and two officers boarded it. At that stage, the sea swelled, rolling the boat and tipping asylum seekers into the water.
On the facts available to me from the press conference, it was completely unnecessary and quite unprofessional, I would have thought.
Tony Kevin is a former ambassador who's followed asylum seeker boat tragedies forensically since 353 people died in the CivEx disaster more than a decade ago.
There had been opportunities through the night using searchlights and loud hailers to establish what the situation was on the boat and to instruct the boat to follow the Ocean Protector safely towards Christmas Island.
Do you think that they were trying to avoid any sort of capsize in the night, which could have been more dangerous than approaching the vessel during the daylight?
That's possible. That's possible. But then one comes back to the question of what they did in the daylight and why did they not, keeping a safe distance from the boat, just use a loud hailer to instruct the boat to follow them to Christmas Island? There are always people on these boats that understand enough English to comprehend simple messages like that. And in that event, the boat would have kept going. It had already said, "We are lost." That was the nature of the distress call, we're told, that it said, "We're lost." And it simply needed to be told where to go.
The Home Affairs Minister, Jason Clare, wasn't available for interview. Tony Kevin says a coronial inquiry is needed.
I think we need to know a lot more about what orders were given in the course of the interception and where those orders came from what level they came. Border Protection Command carries out its responsibilities of intercepting boats and occasionally rescuing them with great efficiency and courage. And I only draw attention to these cases where things go wrong because I think it's very important for the pride of the service that 100% safety record be maintained.
Now turning to some economic news. China faces a debt crisis in the next few years if it doesn't deal with the problem now. Although precise figures are impossible to come by, Michael Pettis, a professor of finance at Peking University, says Beijing needs to greatly lift its efforts at rebalancing the economy. He says this might be painful, but mostly for the elite. He also thinks the government should aim not for 8%, but a 3% economic growth rate. Karen Snowden has more.
Try telling an Australian mining company it would be a good thing if China's growth rate was a mere 3%. There are hundreds of billions of dollars of mining investment resting on China's official preference for 8% or more annual GDP expansion. But Michael Pettis, Professor of Finance at Peking University, says that's probably been overstated for at least the last decade.
It's been growing in real terms less than the official numbers, which have been 10, 11, 12%. And that's part of the problem. China's GDP is probably significantly overstated.
The other part of the problem is the huge size of public debt.
Debt becomes the key issue. And I think by now there is a consensus that if this continues another 3 or 4 years, we run the risk of a debt crisis.
What do we know about the real levels of debt? How serious will be the problem if it's not dealt with, as you say?
Officially, debt levels are not very high, 20 to 25% of GDP. But because most of the expenditures done by the government aren't done directly by the government, they're done through the banking system. All of the losses on the banking system effectively should end up on the government balance sheet. And how much debt is there? We don't really know, but it's at least 80% of GDP for government debt, and it could be significantly higher. We just don't know.
That's absolutely huge.
Yes, it's a much higher number than people expect. And I think, to its credit, the new government recognizes that.
China's growth rate is largely dependent on investment, the building of roads, power stations, apartment buildings and such, meaning more debt. But if the new leadership team in Beijing is serious about rebalancing the economy away from investment to domestic consumption, Michael Pettis says it has to accept lower growth. And it can be done, he says, without social upheaval or higher unemployment, as officials fear.
In fact, the real pain of the adjustment is not going to be on ordinary Chinese if they manage the transition well. Rebalancing means both that GDP growth rates will slow down and the household share will expand, it will grow. So in principle, you could have 3% growth rates in GDP, but still 5 or 6% growth rates in household income, which is not bad. It's the elite, the families and groups that control the state sector, they're the ones who are going to have to bear the brunt of the adjustment, and that's politically very difficult.
Well, they're very powerful vested interests, so there's a big battle looming there if indeed... Yes. The reformers grasp the nettle. But even so, if you're talking about 3% GDP growth for China, that's equivalent to, say, Australia's growth rate, which is going great guns, it thinks, at 3% growth. A whole different picture in China, surely. I mean, I know you've partly explained it, but most people would say 3%, forget it.
If you look at the history of other countries that have had these investment-driven growth miracles, they've always surprised on the downside. So, for example, Japan grew at 7 or 8% a year for 20 to 30 years. In fact, 20 years later, Japan has had average growth rates of below 1%. So my argument is that the historical precedents are pretty clear. These adjustment periods are very difficult and much more difficult than anyone expects.
China could be in for a rough time and be contributing to the risk of more global instability. It's under constant pressure from the US to appreciate its relatively low currency, which gives it an export advantage and a big trade surplus. Michael Pettis argues history is on his side when he says the losers in rising trade tensions will be the current surplus countries, in this case China, and in Europe, Germany.
And historically, the deficit countries win that war. So I think if countries like Germany and China don't significantly reflate domestic demand, it's going to be very hard to see a world in which we don't have increasing trade tensions, and ultimately that'll come at the expense of Germany and China.
And so we can't just muddle through unless these things are sorted out, and it might take international cooperation. Is a repeat of 2008 inevitable?
I think that if you look at the great imbalances, the big economies, the U.S. has started rebalancing. It still has a ways to go, and it's been quite painful, but it started rebalancing. The savings rate is starting to go up. The current account deficit's contracting. Europe hasn't rebalanced at all. In fact, things have gotten worse. And China hasn't rebalanced at all. It's gone backwards. Japan is a bit of a question mark right now. But if you look at it that way, it's hard to see that we've really gotten the crisis behind us. We got the first phase of it behind us, but I think the next few years will continue to be very difficult.
And with that report from Karen Snowden, we've come to the end of this edition of Focus Asia Pacific. If you wish to contact us, our email address is focus@pcjmedia.com. Until next time, friends, this is Keith Parent wishing you well. We'll see you in 7 days. Bye-bye.